The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present Wisdom Books of the Bible, the fourth in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
Mark, if we're going to cover the remainder of the wisdom literature, I'm afraid we'll have to leave the book of Proverbs now. I'm sorry, and I think you are too. It's an enigmatic book. It's full of problems and riddles, and we could linger over it with profit and amusement, too,
and
for a long time.
And full of great figures and metaphors.
It is. It sparkles. But we've got the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Job belonging in the Bible. And we can't ignore the apocryphal books, particularly the book Ecclesiasticus that I know you're very fond of. So that let's pass on now, leave the book of Proverbs more or less unfinished, and go into Ecclesiasticus.
Would you prefer to go into that before you went into the book which is called ordinarily the Wisdom of Solomon? I don't care which one we talk about first.
Well, frankly, I'm not as fond of that book, of the Wisdom of Solomon, as I am of Ecclesiasticus. And I think Ecclesiasticus comes earlier in the tradition.
Very well.
Beside which, Ecclesiasticus was definitely written originally in Hebrew, and we don't know whether the Wisdom of Solomon was written in Greek, it belongs to the Alexandrian period, or whether it was written in Hebrew. So let's go first into the book Ecclesiasticus.
Well, it's quite all right.
And by the way, let's not forget to remind our listeners again that Ecclesiasticus is not the book of Ecclesiastes, as many people think.
No, I suppose it might be easy to misunderstand someone, Maurice, simply because the names do sound alike, but Ecclesiastes is the greater of the books.
Oh, by far.
I mean,
it's shorter, shorter, but it's much greater.
You know, Ecclesiasticus begins more or less as the Proverbs began, with the statement that wisdom comes from the Lord. You remember, we wanted to emphasize the fact that the authors of the book of Proverbs were very eager for us to understand that the ultimate source of wisdom is the Lord.
Yes, there's a tremendous insistence in Ecclesiasticus on that principle. He says, the fear of the Lord is glory and exaltation. To fear the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the fullness of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the crown of wisdom. He goes on in a kind of ecstatic chant about the association between wisdom and the divinity.
Yes, and wisdom is a very great person indeed. There is but one who is wise, a very terrible one, seated upon his throne. The Lord himself created her. He saw her and counted her and poured her out upon all he made, upon all mankind, as he chose to bestow her. But he supplied her liberally to those who loved him. You notice that wisdom is given the feminine gender. Wisdom is not a woman. Let's not say she's a woman, but she's a deity.
Yes.
A goddess.
Well, I wouldn't say a goddess. The word wisdom in Hebrew happens to be feminine, a chochmah, and thence the translation is feminine.
But sometimes she becomes the wise man's bride. I mean, there is a pretty strong emphasis.
Yes,
not
she
upon
feminine.
Her womanhood or upon her godhood. I don't mean that literally either. But she is a very great person. I find them often referring to
her. Yes, they say, make her your bride, make her your sister. They speak of wisdom roaming through the streets in search of men. A very queer figure, by the way. It is as though they were redeeming somebody. Here's a woman stands in the open places and calls to men to come to her. But here is an oddity that I found in Ecclesiasticus that I'd like your comment on. There's always this insistence, seek wisdom, don't let go of her. This is the only path of life. And then you come across this strange passage. Seek not things that are too hard for thee, and search not out things that are above thy strength. The things that have been commanded thee, think thereupon, for thou hast no need of the things that are secret. And be not over busy in thy superfluous works, for more things are showed unto thee than men can understand. How do you interpret this check on a man's curiosity in the midst of this continuous and insistent plea, give yourself completely to wisdom, and here is a caution. Don't go after things that are beyond your intelligence.
Well, I connect that with what we were saying perhaps 2 weeks ago, that wisdom, finally understood, is wisdom, knowledge, understanding of the entire universe, many portions of which, of course, man's imagination cannot penetrate. I think the authors of our books were very serious men. They went the limit in their conception of what understanding is. We do, too. Aren't there things that today, even with all of the knowledge of which we boast, aren't there things that we have to admit we do not understand?
Yes, yes.
If we were to be perfectly wise, perfectly knowledgeable, we would know them, too. It is my own belief that it's the part of wisdom always to recognize one's ignorance, always to respect it. As a matter of fact, religion has been called the art of recognizing our ignorance.
Yes, I agree with that thoroughly. But, Mark, does this mean that there is a positive prohibition on the attempt? Are there areas of human knowledge or human curiosity which it is not seemly to enter? That is what I'm wondering about. As, for instance, there would be in the Jewish tradition an area, the mystical, the Kabbalistic, which for a great many Jews was forbidden. They were too hard, and they were not only that, they were dangerous to a man's reasoning, to a man's intelligence and his mental health.
You mean dangerous to his mental health if he were not somehow prepared, not somehow forewarned against dangers that would not lie there for an expert,
for an expert, initiated. They rarely admitted the likelihood of anyone having equipment to enter those areas of speculation without disastrous consequences. I mean, is that the intention, or is it something else? Is it what you suggest, namely, a passage that occurs in Ecclesiasticus which says, instruction is as fetters on the feet of an unwise man. There are people to whom one should not give instruction because they're not fit for it. Is that also an acceptable principle? You know, Mark, we nearly lost the Book of Ecclesiasticus. I've always regretted that it hasn't been included in the canon, because I consider it at least the equal of the Book of Proverbs, and we almost lost it because the original Hebrew was misplaced, was destroyed, mostly, the copies were mostly destroyed, and only a Greek translation made by the grandson of the author, namely Joshua ben Sira, the grandson made a copy in Alexandria, made a translation, rather, in Greek. And the introduction in which this statement appears is still extant. And only the Greek survived. It was a question at first whether it had been originally Hebrew. Then the Hebrew copy was discovered, strangely enough, about 60 years ago by Dr. Solomon Schechter in a cache of manuscripts in Old Cairo. And by the way, at the same time, he discovered the first of the documents which we today identify as the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was a copy of one of the documents of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the synagogue in Cairo. Well, we nearly lost Ecclesiasticus, and that would have been an enormous loss.
You mean we nearly lost it in this manuscript?
Nearly lost it in the Hebrew.
Yes, in the Hebrew.
The Hebrew has reappeared, and I say that if we had put it in the canon originally, there would never have been this danger. There would never have been this alienation from popular reading.
Well, I'm sure that's very important to take note of. We would give the wrong impression of Ecclesiasticus, of course, if we suggested that its reference was always to the ineffable and unknowable things. Of course, it's often talking about very familiar things, such as the importance of friends. Weren't you struck by the tribute paid to friendship here and the various views taken of it? A faithful friend is beyond price, and his value cannot be weighed. A faithful friend is a life-giving medicine, and those who fear the Lord will find it. The man who fears the Lord will make genuine friendships. It's very interesting to me to see a connection made between the fear of the Lord and friendship.
Do you know, there's much more piety, I discover, in the book of Ecclesiasticus than there is in the book of Proverbs. There is much more interfusion of the presence and awareness of God than in the presumably earlier work, which is the collection of, for the most part, of the sayings of Solomon.
Well,
there's not only what you've just called attention to. There is, in addition to those lyrical and exalted passages on wisdom, down to earth things like, "Hast thou cattle? Have an eye to them, and if they are profitable to thee, let them stay by thee. Hast thou children? Correct them, and bow down their neck from their youth. Hast thou daughters? Give heed to their body." And then he goes off very soon after and says, "Jest not with a rude man, lest thine ancestors be dishonored." Mm. You know what he'll call you if you argue with a rude man.
And of course he tells you not to make sport of an uneducated man. Is that the same thing?
Yes, it's a similar passage. There are, Mark, these strange alternations between the abstract, the cosmic, the universal, and the very simple aphoristic approach to daily affairs, in which he gives you the shrewdest advice, making me think sometimes of Bacon's essays on human conduct. I suppose those are perhaps the, I don't know if you'll agree with me, the most concise, the most pointed, and the shrewdest essays on human behavior. And you have the same thing in Ecclesiasticus, mingled with the lofty considerations of the ultimate meaning of wisdom.
Well, now, the common things that are here, I quite agree with you, are of immense weight, Maurice. To go back to friendship, just for a minute, I was particularly struck in this reading by the emphasis upon that. This statement, for instance, "Do not forsake an old friend, for a new one is not equal to him." I think everybody somehow knows how that is. And then there's the matter of rumors concerning what one's friend has said about one. He says you must be very cautious to believe that. Question a friend. Perhaps he did not do it.
Yes, yes.
Or if he did, so that he will not do it again. Question your neighbor. Perhaps he did not say it. In other words, perhaps this slander has no source. Or if he did, so that he may not repeat it. Question a friend, for often there is slander, and you must not believe everything that is said. A man may make a slip without intending to. Who has not sinned with his tongue? Question your neighbor before you threaten him, and leave room for the law of the Most High. Back, they always come, as you say.
Yes.
To the Most High.
Yes. And then again, a psychological insight. In addition to this accumulated wisdom of experience, there is the kind of insight which is not just the effect of experience, but has an element of the penetrative and inspirational in it. When he says, for instance, there is the kind of man who destroys his soul through bashfulness, and by a foolish countenance destroys it. And there is a kind of man who out of bashfulness promises to his friend, and then he makes him his enemy for nothing. The man that hasn't got the courage to say no when he can't fulfill a request, and out of weakness, you know, they say that the old Chinese custom was never to contradict a man, but afterwards, if you had to negate what you'd said to wriggle out of it, something like this. You'd ask a man, Mark, have you ever been in England? He would say, oh, of course, yes. Yes, I've been in England. I've not exactly been in... The fact is, I've never been out of China, but I very much wanted to be in England.
Yes.
Now, this sort of excessive shyness and timidity can get a man into very grave difficulties, and this is what Ecclesiasticus warns us against.
Yes, he warns us against many things. He warns us against unhappiness, too, because, like the author of Proverbs, this author understands that the fruit of wisdom is a kind of serenity. And the absence of serenity in a man might be a sign of ignorance. Do not give yourself up to sorrow, and do not distress yourself of your own accord. Gladness of heart is a man's life, and exultant joy prolongs his days. Be kind to yourself, and comfort your heart. It's very interesting.
Yes,
be
very
kind
fine,
to yourself,
yes.
And comfort your heart. I love that. A heart that is cheerful and good will pay attention to the food he eats.
Yes. You remember how the heroes in the Iliad, I think it is, sat down after a defeat and very carefully cooked their own meal and ate it while mourning for their comrades. But they cooked it very carefully. This was a seemly and proper thing to do. And yet, you'll agree, I think, on something that we remarked on a week or two ago, that this cheerfulness has nothing to do with the sort of imbecilic, blithering grin that people are supposed to go around with in the modern world. He says quite openly and unashamedly, says, weep for the dead, for light hath failed him. He is not trying to gloss over the tragedies of life. Then he goes on with a kind of deep irony, says, and weep for a fool, for understanding hath failed him. Weep more sweetly for the dead, because he hath found rest, for the life of the fool is worse than death. 7 days are the days of mourning for the dead, but for a fool and an ungodly man, all the days of his life. I mean, mourn all your life long for the man that happens to be a fool.
Well, there's no limit, it seems to me, to the penetration implied here into all the regions of our experience. For instance, the famous passage on silence. You know, it's a famous question whether a man who is silent is silent from wisdom or from foolishness. Ecclesiasticus says, one man keeps silence because he has nothing to say, and another keeps silence because he knows it is the time for it. A wise man will keep silence till his time comes, but a boaster and a fool miss the fitting time.
Even for keeping silent?
Yes.
He keeps silent at the wrong time.
But you know, it is a famous question with many of our friends, I dare say, yours and mine, Maurice, that their silence sometimes is a kind of mystery. We don't know whether it covers immense depths of understanding, almost too great to express,
maybe
sheer shallowness.
Maybe this is one of those areas that we're better not look into.
I think we're
forbidden to investigate. Do you know what I'd like you to read, Mark?
What's that?
That wonderful passage of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. It's something that always moves me with its reverence for the past, its form of recapitulation of the national history, and at the same time, there is in it, I'm going to call attention to when you finish reading it, a very dubious passage as to the role of the little man. Do read that out, because I'm very fond of it.
Well, you spoke last week of the little man, and they had touched me too. As a matter of fact, I often think, when I think of the history of the human race, of those innumerable persons who have held up their corners of the sky, who have done all the work that they needed to do, have reproduced their kind, have been good, faithful, and who have left no record of themselves. They are sometimes, it seems to me, the true heroes of the race, because they did these things for no reward. It's almost more impressive when a man is a good man and an industrious man for the sake of goodness and industry than for the sake of a reward. And there are some who have no memorial and have perished as though they have not lived. And all that whole passage of which you read last week, that accounting for all of those anonymous persons seems to me of the first importance. But the passage of which you speak begins with this line that everyone knows, and that Stephen Spender, an English poet in our time, made a title of one of his poems. Let us now praise distinguished men, our forefathers before us. They are a great glory to the Lord who created them. They have shown his majesty from of old. Men who exercised authority in their reigns and were renowned for their might. They gave their counsel with understanding and brought men tidings through their prophecy. Leaders of the people in deliberation and understanding. Men of learning for the people, wise in their words of instruction. Composers of musical airs, authors of poems and writing. Rich men endowed with strength who lived in peace upon their lands. All these were honored in their generation and were a glory in their day.
And then comes that passage about the small people, yes. The sadness. What you were talking about before strikes me as one of the irresoluble riddles again. Just last week, when we'd been discussing that, I came across a passage in Logan Pearsall Smith's Trivia. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes,
book?
I do.
It's a very beautiful little thing.
Yes.
In which this is reflected again, the very thing you've just been speaking of. He says, when I read in the Times about India and all its problems and populations, when I look at the letters in large type of important personages and find myself face to face with the questions, movements, and great activities, where do I come in? I ask myself uneasily. Then, in the great Times reflected world, I find the corner where I play my humble but necessary part. For I am one of the unpraised, unrewarded millions without whom statistics would be a bankrupt science. It is we who are born, who marry, who die in constant ratios, who regularly lose so many umbrellas, post just so many unaddressed letters every year, and there are enthusiasts among us who, without the least thought of their own convenience, allow omnibuses to run over them or throw themselves month by month in fixed numbers from the London bridges.
Well,
this is the role of a small man.
Yeah, that's a very nice statement of it. The forgotten man, if you please. I never read a newspaper without saying to myself, well, well, think of all the people whose deeds, either good or bad, interesting or uninteresting, are not being recorded here. It's only by a crazy kind of accident that something gets to be considered news by the editors of newspapers. Well, look, if you want to, at the names of the famous persons who are remembered here, there's a great list of them, and we couldn't read the passage in its entirety. First of all, there's Enoch. Is that a good place in your mind to begin?
Yes, isn't that strange? He begins with Enoch, and not with Adam. He leaves Adam for later on. He brings him in sort of offhandedly.
Yeah, there's Enoch, and then there's Noah, who was found perfect and upright. There's Abraham, of course, very soon, the great father of a multitude of nations, Isaac, Jacob. And in that particular passage, Joseph does not follow.
No.
You remember how sweet is the wisdom of old men. That's a quotation from these books. It isn't a reference to us. But, you know, 5 years ago, we were talking about Mann's great Joseph books. And we had occasion to say there, as we have, for that matter, in some of the subsequent years, had occasion to point out that Joseph, for all of his brilliance and for all of his indispensable services to his race, is not very frequently mentioned in books after Genesis. For instance, when some hundreds of years have passed and Moses is to lead his people out of Egypt, he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and
yes.
Jacob.
Yes. And until
God of Abraham,
yes.
Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph.
Yes, until this day we have three patriarchs, although, as you suggest, one might, from Joseph's immense services, have included him and made four patriarchs, but he is not there.
As a matter of fact, he is mentioned a little later here. It seems to me sometimes almost as an afterthought, but the list goes on through Moses.
Well, have you noticed, Mark, he gives little space to Moses and a lot to Aaron.
That's right.
Is that a curious inversion of their roles?
Well, I take it that it could be because Aaron was a priest, don't you suppose so? The priesthood somehow or other by this time, because this is a pretty late book, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
The priesthood had its special importance. I don't know. I'm not sure that I can always understand the distribution of emphasis in space. Phineas.
Phineas is a very odd figure. They sometimes say this Phineas, you know, who's the one who burst in upon the sinners in the tent.
Yes.
In the time when the Jews were in the wilderness and they were sinning at Baal Peor, Phineas burst into the tent and slew the sinner and his paramour. And they've often said that he was later reincarnated in Elijah the prophet, that fiery scourge of sinners, chiefly of kings. And he finds a place here, although very few people remember the name.
That's it. Now, Joshua, of course, does belong here. Caleb, you remember.
Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who, with Joshua, they were the only two of the scouts or spies who didn't come back terrified from their visit into the land of Canaan.
Yes, we spoke of that last year. And then, of course, there are the judges. And first of all, among the judges in this list, Samuel. And it's interesting that when it comes time to mention David, Nathan comes first.
Yes.
Nathan and then David.
Well, he was a very remarkable figure, Nathan. We spoke about him a couple of years ago.
And, of course, Solomon. And then the later kings. But Elijah and Elisha are terribly important.
There's no mention of an important figure like Deborah the prophetess. She was a heroic and valiant figure. No mention of Gideon.
No.
He skips over them, and you could say that is understandable if he had no room, but he spends a lot of time on certain figures and ignores others. There must have been some reason in his philosophy that I can't fathom now.
Well, of course, that always is the case. As biography is written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, emphasis changes and certain persons become more important than others. He does remember at the end, Joseph. No one was ever created on earth like Enoch, nor was a man ever born like Joseph. That's about all, the leader of his brothers, the support of the people, and his
bones were cared for. Well, it's a very strange juxtaposition.
Yes.
Enoch was the most unearthly, the unworldly, in the popular modern phrase. He was out of this world.
Yes.
He was the one of the two mentioned in the Bible who was translated to heaven without the intermediary of death.
This reminds
me. And Joseph was the most worldly of all the biblical figures. It's a queer juxtaposition.
This reminds me, Maurice, we haven't said anything about the wisdom of Solomon, but in that book, there is a passage about immortality. And I take it that immortality, most of the time in that passage, refers to the everlasting memory in other men's minds of one man. Is that true? Or does it become more...
Well, Mark, this question of immortality, we'll have to take that up when we come to the book of Job, because it's a burning question, and it's not the simple question that people imagine. There are many who say that in the Tanakh, in the Jewish Bible, immortality is denied or ignored.
Well, it certainly is not ignored.
No, it is not ignored, and it is not denied either. It's not at all clear as to what they thought about the survival, the Hasharat HaNefesh, as they call it, the survival of the personality after death. It's not at all clear. But we'll have to come to that in its place. And meanwhile, I know that you were very keen on saying something about the wisdom of Solomon, and here we are at the end of our talk. We'll have to let it spill over into the next talk.
Well, I'm not at all sure that it needs to. I quite agree with you that Ecclesiasticus is the richer book.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the fourth in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the last of five entitled Wisdom Books of the Bible. Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.